PSA to the open mic audience. Poets don't love you. They only want you for the poem, for the words others will love long after you're gone, and the applause of how sweet this man must be to write such beautiful love poetry to a woman he hasn't seen in 5 years or more. If a poet ever writes you a love poem, you better run long before they bisect your love like a butcher, grind you down into pieces, because poets don't love you. They just love the sound of their own voices. They speak it. I love you to a poet just means I can make a chapbook out of you.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, everybody. It is Sharon Smith here on Iambic Podcast, and I'm here with the man who we call in the Sacramento poetry the star, the legend. I mean, he's raised up some bars here, but he basically has he has several books, 9 chapbooks, and also has a full-length book you need to get to. Yeah, I think it's called 30 Years.
Finding Home 30 Years Later.
Finding Home 30 Years
Later. It's on Amazon.
And Amazon. And he's basically done, he has three one-man shows, which I am now going to ask him about in a few minutes. But if you have not known him, I don't know where you've been at, because this boy has been on Sacramento. He's been on Good Morning America. He's been on Good Morning Sacramento. He's been on the Sacramento Bee. He's been in the Sacramento News and Review. But Cap Radio. I mean, he's done it. NPR, I mean, and if you're not looking, you may have seen him on Button Poetry, but why am I here to suggest that? Let me talk to David, and yes, Laurent DeMola!
Hello, world.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. It's been like a lot of inward personal focus growth lately.
Inward, huh?
Like, I became a little reclusive in 2019.
Okay.
Just kind of dealing with my own stuff and trying to figure out my own mental health. I've got major depression. I've had it since, forever.
Right.
So, just trying to figure that out a little bit better.
Speaking of the depression and stuff, I know that you've worked in Concord, but you also work with
Hold on. Oh. I need to correct. You never conquer it. Very much a part of my daily process. Just wanted to say that for people out there, because it's...
Okay, you don't
sorry,
conquer it.
I know I'm nitpicking.
You manage it.
It's important. Yeah,
you manage.
I manage it. Yeah.
You're its manager. You and depression are both... You go together.
Most days.
But you're also looked at as... foreseer of the mental health groups and communities. So basically when people look, they look at you somewhat of a guiding light sometimes. So it's very interesting.
I mean, like people, I've never, how do I put it? Like I post a lot about my mental health from a place of healing. And so sometimes people will see that and they'll go like, oh, you know, what do you think of this situation that I'm going through? And really usually what it gets down to is just like, learn your symptoms, learn what you need in the moment, and learn what it takes to give yourself that. Yeah, that's the very, like, very boiled down, very simplified version of it.
Most definitely. You need to get close to the mic, sir.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. I'm getting...
There is change.
I'm not used to, like, where I have to get up on it. Every mic is a little bit different. You just gotta love this one slightly different than the other ones.
You gotta... Now, I'm not saying you have to put your lips or teeth on it. It's just gotta be...
Yeah.
Close.
No, you just gotta tease it. All right, hey, that's a whole other podcast. We don't need to go into that.
But speaking of which, you know, being that you are a local, I wouldn't say a legend, but when I first came to Sacramento, your name was the first thing they threw out before anything else. I mean, this in Sacramento Poetry Center, in Luna's, your name was the first thing thrown
really?
Out.
Wow.
So I was surprised I first met you. I was like, huh? So you're the guy, huh?
So that's it. That's all there is.
But even hearing your poetry, I mean, I was impressed.
Oh, well, thank you.
But what got you into poetry?
So I was like 11, and I was a very angry kid, and I just started writing, just trying to process. I didn't even understand what depression was, and so I was trying to figure out all these weird thoughts in my head. I had attempted suicide earlier in that year, and I was just writing angry stuff about everything.
I pictured his face when I hit you, over and over, while other kids begged me to stop. They all watched. That was the last time I saw you. The next time you get in a fight, John, remember, the trick of throwing a good punch is to aim behind the target like it didn't exist, like salvation was waiting on the back of their eyelids, pushed through them.
And I didn't realize it was poetry until I looked back on it. And my brother Frank and my brother Al and my brother Nick, they all got me into writing in the first place. Mm-hmm. Just through, I used to do, okay, this is something I've never talked about before. I used to do a thing called e-wrestling.
Yeah.
Which is basically you role play a character online as like a professional wrestler, and there's matchups that go on, and you judge who wins based on who writes a better promo.
Really?
That's where I started like actually writing for public consumption.
Okay.
As a kid, writing alongside like 18-year-olds. But yeah.
So, and it's funny that you say that because you do have a poem where you verse depression.
Yeah.
You and depression are versing each other going head to head.
In a pro wrestling match. I've watched pro wrestling since I was a little kid. I've taken a long break from it because it just got so bad.
who was your favorite wrestler? Or just give me two favorite wrestlers. Yeah.
I mean, okay. So as a kid, of course, it was like, you know, Ultimate Warrior, Hulk Hogan. They had a lot of energy. As an adult, I appreciate Jake the Snake Roberts a lot. I love, oh my gosh, like Samoa Joe is so good. AJ Styles is so good. There's people in, like Chris Jericho is by far my favorite nowadays.
Even with the new Extreme, with the new All Extreme Wrestling.
Or the All Elite.
The All Elite, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, his ability to change character and just shift who he is as a performer and still engage the audience is unbelievable.
Oh, okay. I've always been a king to Ricky the Steamboat.
Jack
and the Steamboat when he used to, just the way he flew over the...
Him versus Macho Man.
Oh yes.
That
Macho Man. Yeah. Oh, don't mind. That's the man that just gave everybody, you know, it was beyond him and Hulk Hogan just talking to each other. How much smack talk they can get out.
Yo, listen here, brother.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah. It's almost as bad as Coco Beware. You're like, huh?
Man, yeah. So I mean, I could talk about that for like 2 hours.
I'm all there with you, bro.
This is now a wrestling podcast.
But also, you've also gotten used to improv. You also like improv, too.
Yeah. I've been doing it for about 8-9 years.
Oh, nice.
Started off at American River College at their improv club out there in like 2007-ish. I walked out of my psychology. I was a psychology major in at ARC. And walked out of class late one night. I saw a room full of people having fun. And it was just like, I've just got to see what the hell that is.
Okay.
And I walked in and I got open arms. You know, everybody loved me and everybody just showed love. And I was like, I should come back to this. It was a once a month thing.
Okay.
And then I got pulled into a place called Comedy Sports, which is where I learned professional improv and how to like actually do it as opposed to just like for fun.
Okay.
And then from there with Empire Arts Collective, and I formed a couple of my own groups, one called Yes Anderson, which I was super proud of.
That's where
that was alongside Empire Arts Collective.
That's where that and yes part comes in.
Oh, well, yeah. So I'll try to break it down quick. In improv, there's several rules that are very simple. The first rule is listen. The second rule is yes and, which is basically whatever you say in a scene, I have to agree with it and figure out how to build from it.
Oh.
Because if I say no to you, that shuts down the scene. Even if it gets a laugh, we don't have anywhere to go.
Right.
Like if you say, I brought a Ferrari, and I go, that's not a Ferrari, it's a duck. We can't even agree on how the world functions on a basic level.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's always something to compliment each other back and forth. So, yeah.
So you can do more things with it. So it's like, oh, that's your grandma's Ferrari. She gave it to you last year.
I can live with that as long as it's going to be the Pinto. But speaking of that, since you are into improv, you also do slam poetry. We in the poetry community, there is the thing where there's literal poets. And then there's also spoken word poets, which they basically say is called the page or the stage. So are you more comfortable with the page or the stage or both?
I'm more comfortable with both because when you break it down, it's the same thing. You write the words and then you learn how to speak them out loud. And just because you speak them out loud doesn't mean the words have disappeared from the page and melted away.
Oh, okay.
You know, you still have that to go back to. I write, like we said at the start, I've written 9 chapbooks and a full length as well as 2 albums that all had lyrics to them, which were written down before, you know. And yeah, there's I mean, how deep do we want to get into this discussion of how much I hate that whole attempted distinction, how pretentious it is?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, and it's on both sides. There's spoken word poets who look at literary poets as just being pretentious, uppity, like, oh, well, that's not real poetry.
That's not poetry.
There's literary poets who go, oh, and, you know, absolutely fit that mold.
Yeah.
And look at spoken word as like, you're speaking words out loud with affect and intent. You disgust me.
Oh.
You know, how dare you? It's an affront to the written word. And it comes from a place of, I guess, what's your intent with your poetry? For me, my intent is to help people process their lives. My intent is to also process my own self within all of that. And in order to do that and present it on stage, I have to be able to connect with you first. And I don't mind the monotone reading thing. I get the reason why it happens. It's because you want people to basically take in the word the same way they would if they were reading the poem. But even then, I'll get into that later. But my intent isn't just to be someone who you go, wow, those are some clever words, and then forget what I've written.
Mm.
I want you to remember the message behind it, even if you forget who I am. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's a good way of looking at it.
And it's like the thing that I feel, because I was told once that the reason why people read monotone is because, you know, you want just people to be able to observe the words purely. But even when you read a poem, there's still a voice in your head.
Yes, the speaker.
You still read it. There's still a speaker there.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you supply the voice? You know, that's going to be there regardless.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I have met some poets who have an actual speaker. I know of a couple that basically the husband writes the poetry, but the wife does the speaking of it.
Oh, wow.
It's an interesting group. They're an older couple, but they come sometimes to Luna's when he's presenting something. But it's an interesting thing.
That's a lot of trust.
That is a lot of trust. And he writes in his voice, and then sometimes switches it to her voice, and then just puts her up there and just lets her read it all.
Wow,
and
he just sits in the company. So he writes for her voice?
Writes both. He can write for both.
Oh, wow. Does she? Do you know if she like has any editorial over like...
I don't know. I got to remember her name. I got to look back in the groups.
I'm not expecting you to like, tell me everything about their life. What do they eat for breakfast, Sharon?
You know, they eat grits. Butter.
Yeah.
A little maple syrup. But no, since you're in slam poetry and stuff, mm-hmm. you also carry a belt.
I do.
So are you the Sacramento Slam champion?
So I, in the process of forming the National Poetry Slam team in 2018, I won the Grand Slam Championship tournament that was ongoing for months. And we didn't have any kind of like anything for it at the time. There was no title belt. And I said to myself, I said, this is an opportunity to do something weird, which I love. And so I had a title belt made, like pro wrestling style title belt, Grand Slam Poetry Champion. And the reason why I made it, it's very easy to look at it and go like, oh, you're really wow, like trying to praise yourself and stuff. And to a certain extent, yeah.
Yes, 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 you are.
To a certain extent, absolutely. But it's also because with depression, I tend to like forget in a weird way. Like I did a tour in Europe and it was like a month later, it felt like I hadn't done it. And it's not that I forgot that I went.
Okay.
But the emotional content was just kind of like not there anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It happens with major depression and other such mental illnesses. So it was a reminder to myself, something I could look at and go like, oh yeah, okay, look, you have like physical evidence. Because I've been so quick in my life. I used to be proud of the fact that I only had 3 boxes of things.
Okay.
That I was able to empty everything else out and I didn't have any memories of anything. And so you combine that with the depression issue,
right,
and it feels like my life, I haven't done anything.
But you've done a lot.
Exactly. It is the weird paradox of my mental illness.
I mean, you kind of scare me every time I hear you're doing something. You do.
And so I don't know this for sure. This is just purely in the moment thinking about it. I think a lot of that is me trying to fill that void of going like, I don't feel like I've done anything. And so I feel the need to do something. And I feel that time. Whether that's healthy or not is up to you. But so there's another reason, though, I knew when I bought it, it would make a great gimmick for while I'm going around town. People who don't know our poetry scene could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, "What? Where'd you win that belt?" And it's exactly what happens. People walk up, they'll go, "What? What'd you win?" Because I don't look like a pro wrestler. If you haven't seen me before, I'm a very large man. And they come up, and I get to talk about our poetry scene. So I tell them about SPC. I tell them about Luna's. I tell them about Mahogany. I tell them about Brick House. You know, Speak Out Sacramento. All the beautiful events that we have going on.
Right.
And they're like, "Oh my God, there's a poetry scene here." I'm like, "Yeah, show up."
Even in that spot, you basically are like the masked poet, where you basically have the gloves, the hood, the mask.
There's a whole stage thing too.
The whole stage thing, and you've actually have promoted that in certain, in even a lot of areas, even on Button Poetry. That is kind of your alter ego, your the Mask Avenger type of thing. And with the bell, it just now adds to the formula to it.
Yeah. So my goal is to make it slowly more ridiculous and over the top and wonderful in my way.
You're gonna have the mobile or something?
Yeah.
The Anya's mobile.
Oh, you just started me down a whole path.
It's
going to have a little stage that pops out of the passenger door.
Going to have a little sidekick named Motif or something. Motif, go get him. You can be a dog or a person.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah. They'll have a little tape recorder. I just press a button and it starts doing poems. Oh, my God. See, this is what And Yes does, or Yes, yes And does to you.
Yes. That's what the way is supposed to be. We'll call Cypress be improv. That would be, yeah. That'd be improv. It'd be And Yes and improv.
So with that mask, though, because I wear a mask. It was made by Mad Zanny Masks, a local leather maker. He's amazing. I've known him for a long time. And the original mask was black with blue pinstriping on it, or blue striping on it. And it was, I took it for depression. I called it Mr. Crowley. The second iteration of it is was called Mil Santos, after two Mexican pro wrestlers who are legends, and it was all gold, and it was about self-love and, you know, being proud of yourself. And this third one I had done by Halcyon, who's a local young artist. I had him redo the mask completely. It's wild. It looks like marble that's bleeding down the front, and I'm like, I don't know what this is yet. I'm still trying to figure it out. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out that character and what theme of poetry it's going to bring out.
It's interesting that you said you're now looked at as the poet luchador.
That I like that.
Which comes into mind that you also are Latin descent.
Yeah, so, Cuban and Mexican.
Yeah. So how is in your first generation Cuban?
Yeah, so, my dad's from Cuba. He was there for the revolution as a kid.
So how does that feel from your standpoint, being first generation here in America and stuff?
It's been interesting. So my dad came over when he was, I believe, 14 years old.
Okay.
And after the revolution had happened, he was part of the revolution. He was a newspaper delivery boy.
Oh, okay.
And back then, you know, they'd actually invite you into the house. Like, it was a personal thing. And you'd hand him the newspaper, they'd get you some coffee. Well, if he was at a house where it was part of the revolution, he would have a secret message or something in his shoe.
Ooh.
And it'd be like, here's the message of the day.
Or secret
the
agent, week. Man.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of those. And my grandma on that side of the family, Ophelia, she was part of it, similar, doing a lot of propaganda work. And yeah.
Oh.
So he came to this country and was part of Operation Pedro Pan. The Peter Pan Project.
Oh, okay.
And basically that was a association with the Catholic Church and the United States that they bring Cuban children over to educate them, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes, and then, quote unquote, send them back to Cuba, which wasn't, the second half of that plan wasn't actually part of the plan. It was just the guys. So they keep the kids here in America so that the parents can come over later. And my dad was in Florida for a little bit, and then he got adopted by a family in Tucson, Arizona. A white family. And so he learned a lot of white cultures, white customs, was brought up in a Catholic church. And then you have my mom's side of the family, who my grandma comes from Mexico City. She was born there, and they've lived in Tucson, Arizona ever since.
Huh.
Yeah, that's the quickest rundown I could do.
So I do remember I was listening to
Indomitable
Cities, yes,
yeah.
With Jonathan.
That guy.
And he talked about you had an experience with when you first found out you were Cuban American. And what? Tell us what happened with that.
Yeah, so I found out, and it was like, oh, okay. And I was super proud of it. And I tell this this little white girl, this is in New Hampshire. And I tell her, you know, I'm Cuban. And I was telling people just like, wow, like this is a
You're happy.
Weird thing that just like came into me as a kid. I was super, one of the few things I was just excited about as right. a kid. And she looks at me and she goes, you're not Cuban. You're not, your skin isn't brown. And like that really, really, I don't, am I allowed to swear on this podcast? Yeah, it really fucked me up. There's no lighter way to say it. I was just, because at the time, especially, I was such an angry kid in general. And then it was just like, I was so excited about this thing. It was the first thing I'd been excited about in ages. And it set me off. And yeah.
So being that you are looked at, you can be looked at as not being Latin or being white on both ends. Mm-hmm. You kind of... Doesn't that kind of bring you in? I mean, even in, as American, I hate to say American. Basically,
United
we're
States.
Statement, we're a statement, but
yeah.
Whatever. Does that bring you into, when you go into shows or something, do you try to gauge yourself in the way the venue is or how many people you check out the venue, see how many people, and then you try to gauge from there? Or do you just go straight for and go, hey, I'm Cuban, this is going to be me?
I mean, it's like, I'm Cuban, I'm Mexican. I try to make it clear when I'm on stage, like my identity, not so that other people can be comfortable with what I have to say, but just because it's important to me that like there's a Cuban figure out there, there's a Mexican figure out there, because especially in the poetry scene for a long time, there wasn't a lot of like Hispanic, Latin representation that I could see in my proximity. There were people out there and they're amazing, but to be part of that representation meant a lot and means a lot.
Oh, okay. You do have a poem that does talk about, well, this one in particular, we talk about the white culture.
But they wanted me to act right. They just wanted me to act right. Did nothing to feed my life because white culture loves to try and skip steps. For instance, how it won't pay reparations or confess its own sins but still wants forgiveness for a whole list of shit it won't even fully admit happened. As it rewrites fact into fiction, replaces truth in Texas school books with nonsense.
Yeah, that's the only one that I'm very conscious of. I don't want to do it in rooms that don't have white people in it because I'm not trying to like score points off of it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like right. social points. I want it to actually have a valid audience that will hear it and go like, oh shit.
and one audience that's always been particularly surprised by is your first time coming to SPC.
Yeah.
And who brought you to SPC the first time? And what happened that time?
Who did bring me to SPC
the
first
time? I thought
it was
a Penny. Penny did or something.
Oh, yeah, Penny.
Penny Klein.
I can't remember exactly what happened that.
I remember you telling me the story. I think you told me a little bit of a story saying you came, she saw you, you talked a little bit, and then she put you on stage and you just did like a little improvisational poem and then people kind of gave you the clap of you that you're like, oh, okay, I do poetry.
yeah. I've had that experience a few times. I can't remember that specific moment off the top of my head. But, yeah, it's just kind of like the slow realization that I should be a poet.
And you've been, ever since then, it's been like, every time Penny May asks you or something, you've always been like kind of a staple to come to Sacramento Poetry Center, and people like to hear you. But even with that in mind, you're kind of a circuit, I call it a circuit poet, a person just like comedians. Mm-hmm. They go to each mic they can go to, and they know that they use the material on the venue of the area with like Comedy Spot. They're like, mm-hmm. okay, there's certain jokes I'll use here, but I'll try new stuff right here and then. You also do the same thing too, where you go to different mics of the poet or poetry scene and then try to see. And try to use your stuff on that. Try to see how much they engage.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
For me, it's, I want to see like, well, with that white culture piece, for example, mm-hmm. just because it works on one room and how effective it is doesn't mean it works on every room and is effective in every right. room. And also, just in general, it has a message that I want to put out and actually like hey, you know, white culture has a lot of toxicity in it and is at its core toxic and fucked up. And the whole idea that we're white, not I'm from Europe. There's no history behind white.
Right.
It's just we're all in on skin tone and that's it. And there's nothing to it. Yeah, that's a part of the poem. I don't think I express it heavy, but it's in there for sure. Yeah.
So even with that in mind and stuff, you also hit the mahogany. You also hit, sometimes you even hit Soul Collective and go their mics and stuff. And then you also hit Lunas. Do you have one of them as your home? Well, actually, don't even tell me that. Because the way you do things, everyone can be your home base. Because they all bring you in and they love you.
My niece is 4 years old and she gives zero fucks. A counselor said she may never learn language, and in the middle of saying it, this little girl counted to 20, listed all of her colors with full eye contact. If there was a board game called Who Gives the Least Fucks, she wins before you even start.
You're kind of a Sacramento staple. I hate to say it. I'd love to say that because I'm jealous sometimes.
It's weird. Like, I don't feel that. Like, people tell me that they love my work and they, you know, all of that, and it's not something that's ever been like, it's never entered my brain fully. I don't know if that's a depressive thing. I don't know if that's just a normal human thing, but it's like, I've had a lot of people praise my work and I'm just like, oh, okay, cool. I'm glad you liked it. You know, that's cool to hear.
That's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. And like, I've been a lay Taoist for a long time. I've studied the Tao Te Ching. You know, it's part of what started my path to healing myself. And a lot of the message of that is that it's not you, you know,
okay.
Like if you're focusing on you, then all you're doing is drawing in other negative things that come in. Like if you praise yourself, there is always negativity to follow that.
You shouldn't give up so easy. There's someone just like you waiting for you to be their strength. How can you think it's impossible when you haven't even started running yet? Yeah, I get scared too. I don't know how long I'll be here. I don't know how I'm leaving this world. I get tired from looking at the road ahead, seeing more episodes waiting, future attempts to happen.
The negative go away, but
no, it's like...
It's all the balance.
Like someone who shows off their wealth
and
they get stolen from.
They are signaling.
They are, you know,
signaling, yeah.
And it's being mindful of that interchange of energy, even not just physical things, but like the way you treat yourself causes other people to react in certain ways and life to react in certain ways and rebound on you.
Oh.
Or if you treat yourself as less than, you know, equally, like
people want to see more. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you have pointed out that as much as you are a player, you also have been a host for a lot of several. Which do you like hosting? Or
I love hosting. I love. Okay, so my hosting life started in comedy sports. Okay. I would host the improv shows, and that's really where I learned stage presence.
Right.
Among everything else, stage presence, how to be comfortable on stage because you have to be. You are the show.
Right.
You are what keeps the show running, and then from there, like. By hosting and stage managing at Comedy Sports, I started doing, you know, spoken word events, and I brought that same energy to it, and I like to keep a crowd active but engaged. And,
You also are a teacher, where you have basically have taught students like you did before with your Operation Free Soul.
Yeah, yeah. So Operation Free Soul was a youth mentorship program funded by the Creative Economy pilot program here in Sacramento. And basically it was, I took three young poets and I said, hey, Kaya, Alex Cuevas, and King. I kept like trying to say his government name.
Real.
And I was like, don't say his government name. King. And brought him around, did shows, talked about how to put on a show, how to stage manage, all of that. And it's just, I want to share my lessons more, you know, the things I've learned, because I've learned a lot over the past like 10 years of performing. And I think it's when you reach a certain point, you have to give back your knowledge.
Because I remember you telling me you learned a lot, also a lot of touring from your tour brother, Brandon Leak.
Oh, man, yeah.
Taught you several things and stuff.
That guy, like, he did a whole year of touring and, like, didn't have a job. Like, he made his money touring. So proud of that guy. And that inspired me so much to want to, you know, keep going with what I was doing and enhance it and grow it bigger. Unfortunately, life things have gotten in the way, so I've kind of like put it on the back burner for a bit, but I'm doing other shit. So
speaking of other shit.
Yay.
You basically are the president and founder of the Spoken Word Federation.
Spoken Word Federation. Oh, I got to put on my pro wrestling voice.
Go ahead.
No, just playing. So Spoken Word Federation, it started off as a joke. It started off, I think I was actually talking to you.
Yes.
Yeah. And I brought up the idea, and you were, and it was like, you should do that. And I was like, all right, that's kind of like, I guess. And then I went to someone else, and I was like, hey, you know, I've got this idea. Like, would you want it? And they're like, are you kidding me? Like, what are we doing it next week? Like, you know, get me in. And I realized that there was a want in the poetry scene, and I've always had this theory that, okay, need to back up a little bit. As poets, we say that people don't want to come to poetry events. And, you know, I think the problem is that we don't know how to advertise poetry events to get people to come out in a way that engages them, because the public's exposure to poetry in high school and in educational things are Shakespeare read in a boring monotone voice by a teacher or other students who don't understand the context of it, don't understand the language, Old English. And so they have this idea of poetry as being just like this weird whatever. And my concept with SWF was a test of that, to see if I can pull in people using a pro wrestling ambiance and get them to show up to a poetry event and see them be engaged. And it worked.
Yeah.
Like, we sold out at the Brick House, and everybody, people came from Lake Tahoe. Did you know? Did I ever talk to you about that?
No.
We had people who heard, because I went on a CPR, Capital Public Radio, about it, and they heard it and they said, we got to see this show. And they drove down for that.
Wow.
Like, it blew my mind. So, and they showed up, and they had never been exposed to poetry before. That was the other crazy part.
That is crazy.
And they're just like, this sounds like a wild show. I've got to see it. And they loved it.
Okay.
And it was people who had never thought that they would ever love poetry.
That's an interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting talking to them after the show.
So what you're saying is there's another show that needs to be made.
There is. There is. And it is being lightweight planned at the moment. I have ideas. We have a location semi sort of scouted out. It's in the discussion right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was a participant in that.
Absolutely.
And I did face my comrade Marvin, and I did beat him.
That's exactly what I was about to ask you. I was trying to remember. I was like, how did his match go? You're the one match that I couldn't remember match. Who won it.
I was the first. I was one.
Yeah.
I won it.
Yeah. It was me.
My poems kind of destroyed him. And Russell looked at it like, ooh, this is going to be good.
Well, and so it's one-on-one poets face off against each other. They have entrance music from local artists. And I tried to set it up so that it was people who are comfortable with each other, who would be competitive but not crappy to each other, not take anything personally at the end of the event. Because the whole thing was like, if I did this event and people came out of it like, oh, you know, Sharon this and, you know, Ike Torres that, and I would have failed as a member of this community. But so I tried to set a tone.
Okay.
I hope it worked. I think it worked.
Fine.
Yeah, of just like, all right, we're in this together. It really doesn't matter who wins, because it's just a night of poetry versus...
It matters.
Yeah, it matters. Well, matters. So that gets into what I was talking about, though, the matchups. Mm-hmm. I chose you and Marvin because you two had always been like fake, kind of, sort of...
Frenemies.
Fake. Yeah, frenemies.
We're frenemies.
Yeah. And so at all the SAC Unified Poetry Slam events, you two would always like head to head it, and I was like, I've got to capture that energy.
I love
it. And
him.
It was wonderful.
Love you, Marvin. I do.
I love
Marvin. But no, yeah. So that was basically looking at that was a success. And
yeah, that was an immense success.
Yeah.
It was a test show. And my deal for it, I've been saying, if I ever bring it back, I want to make sure that everybody on the show gets paid more than just a cut of the door.
That's fine.
Because the way that artists and especially poets in the city get paid, it's garbage.
Explain. We got elaborate on that.
So Here's the thing. How long have you been doing poetry?
Right now, I've been doing this for 10 years.
10 years?
Yeah.
What's the most you've ever been paid off of a show?
$20.
$20. That's my point. You've been doing this for 10 years, and $20 is the highest that you can get. Whereas there's bands in this country, in this city, who get paid more, right, a lot more for doing, and I don't mean to disparage the music scene. I'm not trying to, like, there's a lot of worth in our music scene. It's a beautiful music scene, but there's a lot less spiritual content. There's a lot less emotional content. There's a lot less intellectual content that goes into their work, whereas you're doing something that is a service to the city and entertaining at the same time.
Right. But isn't it because most of people don't see poetry as an entertainment?
Yeah.
They see it as, it's been used in so many ways. It's been used as therapy. It's been used, yes, as something that's a pastime. It's basically not used as an entertainment vehicle. It's used in so many other different ways, most of them more in the lectural or in the scholar position, exactly, than they are used in.
And for that, it's, I feel like as an art form, it hasn't flowed with the time.
Right.
And that's because we just haven't pushed it that way yet. So one of my goals has been, since early on, to be the introduction to poetry in a similar fashion that Shel Silverstein was my introduction to poetry.
Okay.
Where Shel Silverstein is the reason why I even went back to poetry.
Oh, you're again now.
Like, as a kid, it was the access point.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I saw Shel Silverstein's work, and just something about the sarcasm and the surrealness of it. I was like, I love this. And being able to be that entry point for older people and for teenagers and for young adults, that's been my goal, one of my goals, as well as talking about major depression.
No, you are the link.
Yeah. And so it's through doing events like SWF that serve that purpose.
but you also do slam poetry. And that's another thing I've asked people and stuff. Do you see, I mean, you may not, you may see the difference. Do you see the difference, or do you experience the difference with being literal poets and slam poets, or do you mostly just see them as they're just the same entity, just in two different?
Literary versus slam, it's, if you look at the high level of slam versus the high level of literary poetry, like the people who are out there that you know that are like, everybody looks at as, oh my God.
Yeah.
On both ends, they're both incredible.
Right.
And they both are just as deep, just as thought-provoking, just as able to capture an image and put it in your head, or an experience or a moment. And so, yeah, I see them as being exactly the same because it's all poetry.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's just like comedians do, they have the stand-up and the improv. And there's different types, but they all fall in the same category.
Yeah.
But some people don't feel that way. That's
fine. Yeah. And I mean, like, even, shoot, for me, even within comedy, improv versus stand-up, I see stand-up and what I do as a spoken word artist as being not that far off.
Right.
Like, I can't remember, I really need to figure out who coined this term, but it was something along the lines of stand-up dramedian.
Really?
And I was like, I love that. I'm going to take that.
That's good.
I think it was, I want to say Steve Martin. But okay. Don't quote me on that at all.
Okay, I'll find out. I'm just Germanian. Yeah. Okay. But so what, I've already looked in some of your stuff. I see you still got NPR. You're still on. What is ZFGs to you?
Zero Forbidden Goals. It is, in this case, in the group is an arts collective group that is focused on showing people the beauty of a number of different art forms. Mainly, like, just because of the makeup of the group, a lot of it's focused on hip-hop.
Okay.
And hip-hop itself in this city has always been misunderstood and maligned by people who don't and haven't even taken 2 seconds to understand it.
Right.
And so, yeah, a lot of the work they do, it's very thought-provoking hip-hop. There's, you know, Spacewalker, who does electronic funk. But it's all about, centered around, what do you want to do? And why are you holding yourself back from doing it? And what's actually stopping you from doing it? Because, like, I know it's very easy to get locked in this idea that you're limited by something. you know, be it whatever resource that you're claiming to have. I mean, shoot, Tony Robbins talks about it all the time.
Yeah.
The you know, what resources are you actually limited by? What's actually stopping you?
That's a good point.
You go, like, money. Well, you can catch a venue around here if you want to do a show, if you're involved in the scene. There's ways to catch a venue to do what you want to do. So what's actually stopping you? Well, people support. Why do you need the people support? What do you need that for? What are you actually trying to do with that?
Yeah. You've got a lot of answers, a lot of questions that people do ask. And it's like, yeah, it's really fun. But speaking of Facebook and stuff, I hear you are the Mrs. Mars.
Yes, Miss Mars. I haven't done it for a while because I've put on a bit of weight. My brother passed in 2017, and I just kind of, things happen. It's grief. And I've put on weight, and so I can't quite do the dance like I used to be able to do the dance. But I would wear a unicorn mask and do interpretive storytelling in silence while she performed music. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope we get Mrs. Mars back. Miss Mars back.
Yeah, and that's so much fun.
But touche. But even from your alter egos, Miss Mars, Slam Poacher. I mean, you may not know, but you also did visual podcasts. You did a couple of podcasts before, and I remember them very closely. You did one on Facebook, and then you also did one. You have also one episode where you basically interviewed Brandon, and I was like, why haven't you gone back in the podcast, or are you still doing it?
The Scene Speak podcast was one that I was doing to just try and capture, like, kind of like what you're doing, actually, exactly right now. I literally just wanted to capture a slice of people's life and how they came to be artists within our scene.
Okay.
And I did, like, I think 10, 12 episodes, something like that.
Right.
And it just, I got busy, and then I had to stop. And then I sold all my recording equipment because I needed just a couple extra dollars at the time. But I've found a new method of recording. Oh. It's been in the back of my head for a bit. So, and then also I was on Sex Positive Podcast.
Yes.
Brown Chicken, Brown Cow. Which was number one on iTunes for sexuality for a number of months, which just shocked the hell out of me.
Yes.
It was a wild and lovely show, and I'm really grateful for the time I had on there. I learned a lot about just production for something like that, because we would do a video podcast, a vodcast, and a podcast as well.
Yeah.
And it was a big production.
You've been to a lot. You've been in a lot of stuff. You ever noticed that?
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying before, it's hard to feel it all. Like, when we talk about it just now, I go like, oh yeah, I did that.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't even a thought in my head, honestly, until you brought up the, like, you've done a few podcasts. I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, yeah, I did, like, Scene Speak. Like, I haven't even thought about that term in so long.
Gotta bring it up.
Yeah.
But, and then you also have some albums. You also have two albums. I did purchase one of your albums before. And I think it was the Bomb one.
When the Bomb Drops. Was one of my one-person shows.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, so it was you did incorporate it to a one-person show.
Yeah. So that was the third one.
Okay.
It was supposed to be... Basically, the whole album actually starts on track 8, and you're supposed to hit the random button.
Oh, really?
And it's just basically a person in an abandoned radio station at the end of the world.
Yes.
And it's his last messages that he's trying to put out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Each and every night, just before the big ball of plasma in the sky hits the horizon line, I can tuck you into bed while this whole world melts into the sweet by and by. But for now... You and I still stand here breathing. All I got left is.
Oh, so that's the. Oh, man, I got to do it right now. I got to do it over again. Put that thing on random. Okay, that's the way. Put on 8, turn that go, and then put in random. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll remember that later.
I like doing weird stuff like that. Like, with all my chapbooks, well, with most of my chapbooks, I should say, I always leave out one line in printing so that when you buy the book, I have to write it in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so you made that trick up.
I mean, I don't know if I like invented it, but it started with Jeffrey Neal.
Okay.
With Little M Press published my book, my first chat book, Amen. And it was an accident. It started off as just like I missed writing that line in when I submitted it. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool though. Like, if you buy the book from me, you get the full poem.
Oh.
Yeah.
The reason why I asked that question is because our good friend Stacey G.
Yeah.
She just performed last night and stuff.
I love that. I saw her do it. I don't know. I think she did it just on her own. I don't think she ever saw me do it.
Okay.
So I don't think she took it from me.
Okay. Because she put it in my, and I was like, she said, I just put that little insert. I forgot that word. I'm like, yeah. I was looking at it. I was like, you forgot it? What did you, in typo?
I just love that personal touch of just like, oh, yeah, no, like, you get the whole poem.
Yeah.
It's not that the poem's incomplete without that sentence, but it is a little oomph.
Yeah.
You know?
A little extra, too. It's like, hey, you got that little sense of that. Yeah. If no one else can read it, you got it. Yeah. Like, I'm like,
I love collector stuff.
And
I
mean, now that you said that, I'm like, huh, so you made that trick up. Now I see it. Now I can't really bother anymore. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes more sense. But no, yeah, that's an interesting thought. Never thought of that. It's a little trick. But yeah, I do have Amen. Oh, I do have the chapbook Amen. And man,
I was just talking to Jeffrey about that a couple days ago.
Yeah.
And it's I love the fact that, like, I never said no to myself on writing a chapbook. Because it's, I could have very easily with Amen been like, and I was for a little while, these aren't quite the poems I want. I'm not like, they're not there, you know, it's not the poetry that I want to be writing.
Oh.
But it's where I was at the time. It's reflective of who I was in that moment. And I was proud of the work that came out. But it was after I finished it, I was like,
but okay, you've also you also did one for 24 hours.
Yeah, I did the 24-hour chatbot.
Yeah. So I'm like, what do you mean?
But it was like, at the time, because Amen was my first chatbook. And so looking back at it, I'm like, I could have done so much better. But also, I love the fact that it is a window into, like, young David writing, or younger David writing, versus, and you get to see the progression through all the chatbooks, is my point, I guess.
And have you reread a few of them? Just yourself as you've grown?
I go back once in a while when I'm like, I need to, especially when I'm like, I need to remind myself of, like, how far I've come.
Okay.
And I'll go from Amen, and I'll go Beautiful, and then to Confessions of a First Generation Alien, and then on up to Group Therapy.
Even your full-length book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's got, like, a lot of repeating poems, but it's got a lot of stuff that's never been published before.
Huh.
Most of it's stuff that's never been published before.
I can only applaud you, man. I mean, I do every time. When I say "and yes," somehow really someone knows. Even it's not even, you don't have to be in the poetry scene. They know you, comedy or even singers. I mean, they know you, and I think it's sometimes I've been out of the state, and I said your name once, and some organ person came up to me and it's like, "Yo, you know "and yes"?
Oh yeah, I've done some tours up there,
and I was like, it's gone freaking all the way over here too.
Yeah, can I just say though, so as the youngest brother of three growing up, my brother Frank, back when he was alive, we went to the same high school for just a year.
Okay.
And we had moved from New Hampshire to Folsom, California.
Oh, okay.
I was in eighth grade, and then I transitioned to high school. So this is my brand new people. Like, I don't know anybody.
Right.
My brother Frank had been in high school for his senior year there, year before I jumped in.
Oh, no, no.
And he became, in that year, like, the most popular kid at school.
Oh.
He was. He was the person who would run, like, the prep rallies.
Okay.
And he did all sorts of wild stuff with pro wrestling involved in it. Like, we did at a talent show, I was the ref for a pro wrestling match.
Oh, nice.
And we ended with a 3D to him with, I can't remember the other guy's name, Zach Mann, I think. And But he did all this stuff,
right,
and people knew him. And so my whole time at high school, even up to the moment I graduated, people were like, oh, you're Frank's little brother. And I get out of high school and I go to college out at ARC in Sac State. And people are like, oh, you're Frank's little brother. And he, you know, worked in coffee. And after I graduated from college, it was, oh, hey, you're Frank's brother. And so part of my deep petty hope was that as I get older and I get, you know, more known in poetry, people will go like, oh, you're David's brother to him.
You know what, man?
And it was starting to happen.
You know what? Shout outs to Frank.
Yeah,
man.
He's honestly an amazing guy.
I knew Frank a brief moment, but I did appreciate him a lot. And you know what? You don't have to be just known as Frank's brother. You are his spiritual thing.
No, I know. And it's just like he did so much amazing stuff. Like even just doing a job selling coffee, mm-hmm. which you go like, how do you change people's lives with that? He would go in on his own time because he would sell coffee to businesses.
Oh, okay.
And like, you know, and the espresso machine and help teach them how to use it. And then on top of that, like out in Roseville, there's a coffee shop, and forgive me, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head for some reason, but he helped put up drywall.
Oh, okay.
And just on his own time, not on the clock, just like, hey, you guys look like you need the help. I'm here for it. And he would teach him how to run the business and teach him how to, you know, to sell coffee and pull a shot and all of that.
Damn.
Yeah, like that's the kind of person my brother was. And that's he wasn't putting on a show for anybody. He didn't tell anybody about it. That's just what he did.
If I talk to you more about Frank, I'd be like, man, I knew that more. I just knew him coming. I just knew he came around more often than not to see you. I'm like, oh, he's Frank's brother. Oh, that's David's brother. Okay, cool. And we have a few moments of chats, but it's knowing that he's done that much and stuff, man. It makes me have a different, I never had a different opinion on him, but I've always had an interesting, unique thought of how he is with you.
Yeah, and it's like, like I said, and out of my brothers, he was one of the main reasons why I started writing in the first place. He would hand me stacks of poetry books and go like, you need to read this just to educate yourself. And he would give me long speeches on how I need to change my life, you know, when I was younger and like, because I was an angry, out of focus kid and like 30 minute just, I'm telling you how to live your life now and change and become a better person. And I was also a little shit, so I wouldn't listen to most of it, and I would put the books in the corner. But he exposed me to the opportunity to change because he always believed in me. That's who my brother was. He was just this person who wanted to make the world a little bit better than it had been before because we had all been through shit as kids. And, you know, he knows what it's like to feel lost. And, like, the world is a cruel, messed up place.
Man, I still can't get off of that. But, yo, man, where can they find you?
Ooh.
Where can they find your work?
All over the place.
Yeah, you are all over the place, but where can they, where can they start with the guiding light to go?
The central hub for everything. You can find it at andyespoetry.com. That's where you can find my Amazon links to get the book printed, the Kindle Direct links, I should say, to get the book printed. That's where you can find access to the albums and stuff that are on iTunes, Spotify, all. Where do you buy music? It's there. And as well as I'm going to be starting like a blog on there. I'm still figuring out exactly what I want from that. And I have a podcast, Lightweight, in the back of my head that I'm going to be starting up. And you can catch me on Poets and Politics with Brandon Leake. It's something that we're starting real soon here.
Okay.
Where it's out in Stockton. It's me, Two Cents, Stacey G, and Brandon. And we're out there talking about poetry, talking about political situations in our world from Stockton politics to 45, you know.
So that's coming soon.
Yeah, we've recorded 4 episodes as the time of recording here, and I think we're coming out like next month.
Oh, okay, yeah, people will check that out. Poets and Politics, you know, it's gonna be on hit.
Yeah.
I will probably be on one of their episodes, so I get myself over back in Stockton. Stockton, yeah. Boy, Stockton.
There's so much, like, for all the shit that people give Stockton, there's a lot of change happening in that city, and a lot of things Sacramento should be taking notes on.
I never thought that. You know, being from the 209 myself, I mean, I lived in Stockton for 15 years, so.
No, I mean, like, Mayor Tubbs is actively looking to make something good out there.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I wish it was that way in Sacramento.
You hear that, Sacramento? That means y'all need to wake up.
Yeah.
It's 2020.
Honestly, I mean, that's a whole other podcast. I don't even want to jump into it.
But no, man, thank you for coming on, joining me on my podcast here at the Sacramento Poetry Center. And I wish you better luck, man.
I wish you good luck
and everything else and everything you do in your endeavors. And I will be part of some of that stuff. And you will call me for the Sacramento word, Sacramento Spoken Word Federation next match, because I want to take on somebody. Ike, I'm looking for you.
I mean, you won the match. You're in
on the next show for sure. I'm looking for you.
No, and like, thank you for having me on the podcast. And
oh,
like,
definitely, man.
You've been kicking ass. Keep kicking ass.
I try. Yeah. Most definitely. Yeah, y'all can find, you can find Iambic Podcast on iambic.podbeam.com, or you can look on Rest Wonderland. That's RESWonderland.com/iambic. That's RestWonderland.com/iambic. You can check me on my Facebook and also Iambic's Facebook page, which is Iambic Mag. So keep it locked, and we'll see y'all in the next podcast.
Bye-bye.